my place in tech changes every day. But I don't fear the future, because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts, so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Whose morals are we being fed when we watch sci-fi? Back in 1999, the first of the Star Wars prequels was ruling the box office, but David Brin wasn't so excited. Writing in Salon, he contrasts the despotism of George Lucas's universe with the populism of Star Trek. Read by me, Carl Miller for Curio.io. Well, I boycotted Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, for an entire week. Why? What's the boycott? Isn't Star Wars good old-fashioned sci-fi? Harmless fun? Some people call it eye candy, a chance to drop back into childhood and punt your adult cares away for 2 hours. Dwelling in a lavish universe where good and evil are vividly drawn, without all the inconvenient counterpoint distinctions that clutter daily life. Got a problem? Cleave it with a lightsaber. Wouldn't you love, just once in your life, to dive a fast little ship into your worst enemy's stronghold and set off a chain reaction, blowing up the whole Megillah from within its rotten core, while you streak away to safety at the speed of light? It's such a nifty notion that it happens in 3 out of 4 Star Wars flicks. Anyway, I make a good living writing science fiction novels and movies, so Star Wars ought to be a great busman's holiday, right? One of the problems with so-called light entertainment today is that somehow, amid all the gaudy special effects, people tend to lose track of simple things like story and meaning. They stop noticing the moral lessons the director is trying to push, yet these things matter. By now it's grown clear that George Lucas has an agenda, one that he takes very seriously. After 4 Star Wars films, alarm bells should have gone off, even among those who don't look for morals in movies. When the chief feature distinguishing good from evil is how pretty the characters are, it's a clue that maybe the whole saga deserves a second look. Just what bill of goods are we being sold between the frames? 1. Elites have an inherent right to arbitrary rule. Common citizens needn't be consulted. They may only choose which elite to follow. 2. Good elites should act on their subjective whims without evidence, argument, or accountability. 3. Any amount of sin can be forgiven, if you are important enough. 4. True leaders are born. It's genetic. The right to rule is inherited. 5. Justified human emotions can turn a good person evil. That is just the beginning of a long list of moral lessons relentlessly pushed by Star Wars, lessons that starkly differentiate this saga from others that seem superficially similar, like Star Trek. We'll take a much closer look at some stark divergences between these 2 sci-fi universes below. Above all, I never cared for the whole Nietzschean Übermensch thing, the notion, pervading a great many myths and legends, that a good yarn has to be about demigods who are bigger, badder, and better than normal folk, by several orders of magnitude. It's an ancient storytelling tradition based on abiding contempt for the masses, one that I find odious in the works of A.E. Van Vogt, E.E. Smith, L. Ron Hubbard, and wherever you witness slan-like super-beings deciding the fate of billions without ever pausing to consider their wishes. Wow, you say. If I feel that strongly about this, why just a week-long boycott? Why see the latest Star Wars film at all? Because I am forced to admit that demigod tales resonate deeply in the human heart. Before moving on to the fun stuff, will you bear with me while we get serious for a little while? In The Hero with 1,000 Faces, Joseph Campbell showed how a particular rhythmic storytelling technique was used in almost every ancient and pre-modern culture, depicting protagonists and antagonists with certain consistent motives and character traits, a pattern that transcended boundaries of language and culture. In these classic tales, the hero begins reluctant, yet signs and portents foretell his preordained greatness. He receives dire warnings and sage wisdom from a mentor, acquires quirky but faithful companions, faces a series of steepening crises, explores the pit of his own fears, and emerges triumphant to bring some boon-slash-talisman-slash-victory home to his admiring tribe-slash-people-slash-nation. By offering valuable insights into this revered storytelling tradition, Joseph Campbell did indeed shed light on common spiritual traits that seem shared by all human beings. And I'll be the first to admit it's a superb formula, one that I've used at times in my own stories and novels. Alas, Campbell only highlighted positive traits, completely ignoring a much darker side, such as how easily this standard fable template was co-opted by kings, priests, and tyrants, extolling the all-importance of elites who tower over common women and men. Or the implication that we must always adhere to variations on a single story, a single theme, repeating the same prescribed plot outline over and over again. Those who praise Joseph Campbell seem to perceive this uniformity as cause for rejoicing, but it isn't. Playing a large part in the tragic miring of our spirit, demigod myths helped reinforce sameness and changelessness for millennia, transfixing people in nearly every culture, from Gilgamesh all the way to comic book superheroes. It is essential to understand the radical departure taken by genuine science fiction, which comes from a diametrically opposite literary tradition, a new kind of storytelling that often rebels against those very same archetypes Campbell venerated. An upstart belief in progress, egalitarianism, positive-sum games, and the slim but real possibility of decent human institutions. And a compulsive questioning of rules. Authors like Greg Bear, John Brunner, Alice Sheldon, Frederick Pohl, and Philip K. Dick always looked on any prescriptive storytelling formula as a direct challenge, a dare. This explains why science fiction has never been much welcomed at either extreme of the literary spectrum, comic books and high literature. Comics treat their superheroes with reverent awe, as demigods were depicted in the Iliad. But a true science fiction author who wrote about Superman would have earthling scientists ask the handsome Man of Steel for blood samples, even if it means scraping with a super fingernail, in order to study his puissant powers and maybe bottle them for everyone. As for the literary elite, postmodernists despise science fiction because of the word science, while their older colleagues, steeped in Aristotle's poetics, find anathema the underlying assumption behind most high-quality SF, the bold assertion that there are no eternal human verities. Things change, and change can be fascinating. Moreover, our children might outgrow us. They may become better, or learn from our mistakes and not repeat them. And if they don't learn, that could be a riveting tragedy, far exceeding Aristotle's cramped and myopic definition. On the Beach, Soylent Green, and 1984 plumbed frightening depths. Brave New World, The Screwfly Solution, and Fahrenheit 451 posed worrying questions. In contrast, Oedipus Rex is about as interesting as watching a hooked fish thrash futilely at the end of a line. You just want to put the poor, doomed King of Thebes out of his misery and find a way to punish his tormentors. This truly is a different point of view, in direct opposition to older elitist creeds that preached passivity and awe in nearly every culture, where a storyteller's chief job was to flatter the oligarchic patrons who fed him. Imagine Achilles refusing to accept his ordained destiny, taking up his sword and hunting down the fates, demanding that they give him both a long life and a glorious one. Picture Odysseus telling both Agamemnon and Poseidon to go chase themselves, then heading off to join Daedalus in a garage startup company, mass-producing wheeled and winged horses so that mortals could swoop about the land and air like gods, the way common folk do today. Even if they fail and jealous Olympians crush them, what a tale it would be. This storytelling style was rarely seen till a few generations ago, when aristocrats lost some of their power to punish irreverence. Even now, the new perspective remains shaky, and many find it less romantic, too. How many dramas reflexively depict scientists as mad? How few modern films ever show American institutions functioning well enough to bother fixing them? No wonder George Lucas publicly yearns for the pomp of mighty kings over the drab accountability of presidents. Many share his belief that things might be a whole lot more vivid without all the endless, dreary argument and negotiating that make up such a large part of modern life. If only someone would take command, a leader. Some people say, why look for deep lessons in harmless, escapist entertainment? Others earnestly hold that the moral health of a civilization can be traced in its popular culture. In the modern era, we tend to feel ideas aren't inherently toxic. Yet who can deny that people, especially children, will be swayed if a message is repeated often enough? It's when a lesson gets reiterated relentlessly that even skeptics should sit up and take notice. The moral messages in Star Wars aren't just window dressing. Speeches and lectures drench every film. They represent an agenda. Can we learn more about the Star Wars worldview by comparing George Lucas's space adventure epic to its chief competitor, Star Trek? The differences at first seem superficial. One saga has an Air Force motif, tiny fighters, while the other appears naval. In Star Trek, the big ship is heroic, and the cooperative effort required to maintain it is depicted as honorable. Indeed, Star Trek sees technology as useful and essentially friendly, if at times also dangerous. Education is a great emancipator of the humble, e.g. Starfleet Academy. Futuristic institutions are basically good-natured, the Federation, though of course one must fight outbreaks of incompetence and corruption. Professionalism is respected. Lesser characters make a difference, and henchmen often become brave whistleblowers, as they do in America today. In Star Trek, when authorities are defied, it is in order to overcome their mistakes or expose particular villains, not to portray all institutions as inherently hopeless. Good cops sometimes come when you call for help. Ironically, this image fosters useful criticism of authority because it suggests that any of us can gain access to our flawed institutions if we are determined enough, and perhaps even fix them with fierce tools of citizenship. By contrast, the oppressed rebels in Star Wars have no recourse in law or markets or science or democracy. They can only choose sides in a civil war between two wings of the same genetically superior royal family. They may not meddle or criticize. As Homeric spear carriers, it's not their job. In teaching us how to distinguish good from evil, Lucas prescribes judging by looks. Villains wear Nazi helmets, they hiss and leer or have red glowing eyes, like in a Ralph Bakshi cartoon. On the other hand, Star Trek tales often warn against judging a book by its cover, a message you'll also find in the films of Steven Spielberg, whose spunky everyman characters delight in reversing expectations and asking irksome questions. Above all, Star Trek generally depicts heroes who are only about 10 times as brilliant, noble, and heroic as a normal person, prevailing through cooperation and wit rather than because of some inherited godlike transcendent greatness. Characters who do achieve godlike powers are subjected to ruthless scrutiny. In other words, Trek is a prototypically American dream, entranced by notions of human improvement and a progress that lifts all. Gene Roddenberry's vision loves heroes, but it breaks away from the elitist tradition of princes and wizards who rule by divine or mystical right. By contrast, these are the only heroes in the Star Wars universe. Yes, Trek can at times seem preachy or turgidly politically correct. For example, every species has to mate with every other one, interbreeding with almost compulsive abandon. The only male heroes who are allowed any testosterone are Klingons, because cultural diversity outweighs sexual correctness. In other words, it's okay for them to be macho, because it is their way. Star Trek television episodes often devolved into soap operas. Many of the movies were very badly written. Nevertheless, Trek tries to grapple with genuine issues, giving complex voices even to its villains, and asking hard questions about pitfalls we may face while groping for tomorrow. Anyway, when it comes to portraying human destiny, where would you rather live, assuming you'll be a normal citizen and no demigod? In Roddenberry's Federation or Lucas's Empire? Lucas defends his elitist view, telling the New York Times, "That's sort of why I say a benevolent despot is the ideal ruler. He can actually get things done. The idea that power corrupts is very true, and it's a big human who can get past that." In other words, a royal figure or demigod, anointed by fate, like a billionaire movie maker. Lucas often says we are a sad culture, bereft of the confidence or inspiration that strong leaders can provide. And yet, aren't we the very same culture that produced George Lucas and gave him so many opportunities? The same society that raised all those brilliant experts for him to hire, boldly creative folks who pour both individual inspiration and cooperative skill into his films. A culture that defies the old homogenizing impulse by worshiping eccentricity, with unprecedented hunger for the different, new, or strange? In what way can such a civilization be said to lack confidence? In historical fact, all of history's despots combined never managed to get things done as well as this rambunctious, self-critical civilization of free and sovereign citizens, who have finally broken free of worshipping a ruling class and begun thinking for themselves. Democracy can seem frustrating and messy at times, but it delivers. Having said all that, let me again acknowledge that Star Wars harks to an old and very, very deeply human archetype. Those who listened to Homer recite the Iliad by a campfire knew a great drama. Achilles could slay 1,000 with the sweep of a hand, as Darth Vader murders billions with the press of a button. But none of those casualties matters next to the personal saga of a great one. The slaughtered victims are mere minions, extras without families or hopes to worry about shattering. Spear carriers, only the demigod's personal drama is important. Thus, few protest the apotheosis of Darth Vader, nay, Anakin Skywalker, in Return of the Jedi. To put it in perspective, let's imagine that the United States and its allies managed to capture Adolf Hitler at the end of the Second World War, putting him on trial for war crimes. The prosecution spends months listing all the horrors done at his behest. Then it is the turn of Hitler's defense attorney, who rises and utters just one sentence. "But your honors, Adolf did save the life of his own son." Gasp! The prosecutors blanch in chagrin. "We didn't know that. Of course all charges should be dismissed at once." The allies then throw a big parade for Hitler down the avenues of Nuremberg. It may sound silly, but that's exactly the lesson taught by Return of the Jedi, wherein Darth Vader is forgiven all his sins because he saved the life of his own son. How many of us have argued late at night over the philosophical conundrum, would you go back in time and kill Hitler as a boy if given the chance? It's a genuine moral puzzler with many possible ethical answers. Still, most people, however they ultimately respond, would admit being tempted to say yes, if only to save millions of Hitler's victims. And yet, in The Phantom Menace, Lucas wants us to gush with warm feelings towards a cute blonde little boy who will later grow up to murder the population of Earth many times over. While we're at it, why not bring out the Hitler family album so we may croon over pictures of adorable little Adolf and marvel over his childhood exploits? He too was innocent till he turned to the dark side, so by all means, let us adore him. To his credit, Lucas does not try to excuse this macabre joke by saying it's only a movie. Rather, he holds up his saga like an agonized Greek tragedy worthy of Oedipus, an epic tale of a fallen hero trapped by hubris and fate. But if that were true, wouldn't Star Wars by now have given us a better than caricature view of the dark side? Heroes and villains would not be distinguished by mere prettiness. The moral quandaries would not come from a comic book. Don't swallow it. The apotheosis of a mass murderer is exactly what it seems. We should find it chilling. Remember the final scene in Return of the Jedi, when Luke gazes into a fire to see Obi-Wan, Yoda, and Vader smiling in the flames? I found myself hoping it was Jedi hell for the amount of pain those three unleashed on their galaxy and for all the damned lies they told. But that's me. I'm a rebel against Homer and Achilles and that whole tradition. At heart, some of you are too. This isn't just a one-time distinction. It marks the main boundary between real, literate, humanistic science fiction or speculative fiction and most of the movie sci-fi you see nowadays. The difference isn't really about complexity, childishness, scientific naivety, or haughty prose stylization. I like a good action scene as well as the next guy and can forgive technical gaffes if the story is way cool. The films of Robert Zemeckis take joy in everything, from rock and roll to some deep scientific paradox, feeding both the child and the adult within. Meanwhile, noir tales like Gattaca and The 13th Floor relish dark stylization while exploring real ideas. Good SF has range. No, the underlying difference is that one tradition revels in elites, while the other rebels against them. In the genuine science fiction worldview, demigods aren't easily forgiven lies and murder. Contempt for the masses is passé. There may be heroes, even great ones, but in the long run, we'll improve together, or not at all. See my note on the Enlightenment, Romanticism, and science fiction. That kind of myth does sell. Yet even after rebelling against the Homeric archetype for generations, we children of Pericles, Ben Franklin, and H.G. Wells remain a minority. So much so that Lucas can appropriate our hand-created tropes and symbols, our beloved starships and robots, for his own ends, and get credited for originality. As I mentioned earlier, the mythology of conformity and demigod worship pervades the highest levels of today's intelligentsia, and helps explain why so many postmodernist English literature professors despise real science fiction. When Joseph Campbell prescribed that writers should adhere slavishly to a hackneyed plot outline that preached submission for ages, he was lionized by Bill Moyers and countless others for his warm and fuzzy human insight. Indeed, his perceptions were compassionate and illuminating. Still, a frank discussion or debate might have been more useful than Campbell's sunny monologue. As in the old fable about a golden-haired king, no one dared point to the bright ruler's dark shadow or his long trail of bloody footprints. I admit we face an uphill battle winning most people over to a more progressive egalitarian worldview, along with stirring dreams that focus on genuine problems and heroes, not demigods. Meanwhile, Lucas knows his mythos appeals to human nature at a deep and ancient level. Hell, it appeals to part of my nature, which is why I knew I'd cave in and see The Phantom Menace after my symbolic one-week boycott expired. In fact, let me confess that I adored the second film in the series, The Empire Strikes Back. Despite Yoda's kitschy pseudo-zen, one could easily suspend disbelief and wait to see what the Jedi philosophy had to say. Millions became keyed up to find out, at long last, why Obi-Wan and Yoda lied like weasels to Luke Skywalker. Meanwhile, the script sizzled with originality, good dialogue, and relentlessly compelling characters. The action was dynamite, and even logical. Common folk got almost as much chance to be as heroic as the demigods. Clichés were few, and terrific surprises abounded. There were fine foreshadowings, promising more Marvels and sequels. It was simply a great movie. Homeric, but great. You already know what I think of what came next, but worshipping Darth Vader only scratches the surface. The biggest moral flaw in the Star Wars universe is one point that Lucas stresses over and over again through the voice of his all-wise guru character, Yoda. Let's see if I get this right. Fear makes you angry, and anger makes you evil, right? Now, I'll concede at once that fear has been a major motivator of intolerance in human history. I can picture knightly adepts being taught to control fear and anger, as we saw credibly in The Empire Strikes Back. Calmness makes you a better warrior and prevents mistakes. Persistent wrath can cloud judgment. That part is completely believable. But then, in Return of the Jedi, Lucas takes this basic wisdom and perverts it, saying, if you get angry, even at injustice and murder, it will automatically and immediately transform you into an unalloyed evil person. All of your opinions and political beliefs will suddenly and magically reverse. Every loyalty will be forsaken, and your friends won't be able to draw you back. You will instantly join your sworn enemy as his close pal or apprentice, all because you let yourself get angry at his crimes. Say what? Could you repeat that again slowly? In other words, getting angry at Adolf Hitler will cause you to rush right out and join the Nazi party? Excuse me, George, could you come up with a single example of that happening? Ever. That contention is in itself a pretty darn evil thing to preach. Above all, it is just plain dumb. It raises a question that someone should have asked a long time ago. Who the heck nominated George Lucas to preach sick popcorn morality at our children? If it's only a movie, why is he working so hard to fill his films with this crap? I think it's time to choose, people. This saga is not just another expression of the Homeric archetype, extolling old hierarchies of princes, wizards, and demigods. By making its centerpiece the romanticization of a mass murderer, Star Wars has sunk far lower. It is unworthy of our attention, our enthusiasm, or our civilization. Lucas himself gives a clue when he says, a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Right on. Star Wars belongs to our dark past, a long, tyrannical epoch of fear, illogic, despotism, and demagoguery that our ancestors struggled desperately to overcome, and that we are at last starting to emerge from, aided by the scientific and egalitarian spirit that Lucas openly despises, a spirit we must encourage in our children if they are to have any chance at all. I don't expect to win this argument anytime soon. As Joseph Campbell rightly pointed out, the ways of our ancestors tug at the soul with a resonance many find romantically appealing, even irresistible. Some cannot put the fairy tale down and move on to more mature fare. Not yet, at least. Ah, well. But over the long haul, history is on my side, because the course of human destiny won't be defined in the past. It will be decided in our future. That's my bailiwick, though it truly belongs to all of you, to all of us. The future is where our posterity will thrive. That was Star Wars Despots vs. Star Trek Populists by David Brin, writing in Salon on the 15th of June, 1999, read by Carl Miller for Curio.io.